This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, welcome to the programme. Now, when I tell you that Vitol, a commodities trading company that most people have never heard of, has a turnover of $150 billion a year, you'll understand why we want to talk about our topic today. Commodities. This is a sector of such fundamental importance to the world economy, and yet one that is so little understood. As long as it works, we don't think much about it. From oil to iron ore, coal to cotton to pork bellies, they're all produced, bought and sold through what can sometimes appear to be a complicated system, from producers to the trading middlemen and beyond. So our intention is to lift the bonnet on this industry and take a look at the engine and how well it's working. And I have three guests intimately tied up with the whole sector to help. And first up is Andrew Gowers, head of corporate affairs at a company called Trafigura. Just tell us what the kind of size of Trafigura is and what you do, Andrew.
Well, Trafigura is also a $150-odd billion turnover company. It's existed for only 25 years and has become one of the leading traders of oil and refined products on the one hand, non-ferrous metals, meaning copper, aluminium and the like, and bulk minerals, which is coal and iron ore. So we're a top three player in all the products we trade.
Right. So Glencore, Vitol, you, these are companies that are all in this sector. Now, you call yourself a trading company. Is it just trading, or should we think of you as a company that also mines, transports, organises logistics and stores as well?
In a way, trading is an unfortunate tag because it gets tied up in people's minds with sort of financial speculation and, the financial crisis and so forth. Actually, trading, in the sense that we do it, is a very physical business. It's a logistical business. It's organising the supply chain for commodities from producers, where they come out of the ground, buying them there, transporting them, risk managing all the way to the processors, the refiners and the smelters, and then on to the end consumer. So we're, if you like, the sort of DHL of commodities, with the difference that we actually take ownership of the commodities while they're on the way.
Right. So you have a financial stake in the commodities, but you do you kind of get your hands dirty and you might touch them at some point in the process.
Absolutely. Risk managing, the physical handling of commodities and the finance and all the insurance and all of that is absolutely central to the business.
OK, well, we'll hear much more detail about what you do. Also with me, though, is Jean-François Lambert from Lambert Commodities. You're the founding partner there, and that's a consulting business.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But look, what's interesting about you, Jean-François, is you were working at HSBC in this area. So what were you doing at a big bank when it comes to commodities?
Well, what I was doing very simply was to organize, create the activity of financing the commodity business. The commodity business, as you heard from Andrew, is a very peculiar activity, and it needs very special skills to be safely financed. And what I did at HSBC was to create and form and structure and organize this activity.
Right. So Andrew's company, Trafigura, wants to buy a shipment of oil and to ship it somewhere. They borrowed money from someone like HSBC to pay for that, and then they can pay it back when they've sold the oil later on. Is that the basic idea?
The basic idea is absolutely that. I mean, a trading company is working with other people's money, and these other people are mostly banks.
Right. Let me introduce my third guest, Colin Hamilton, Managing Director of Commodities Research at BMO Capital Markets, BMO, formerly Bank of Montreal. Colin, your business is market intelligence, and you write about commodities. So who buys your research?
So my research goes to a combination of institutional investors. It goes to corporates. So many of Trafigura, for example, would read my research every day to keep them up to date with the markets and understand what's going on. And my job is to, look smart. I'm meant to know what drives these markets. I'm meant to know how these markets may react to different macroeconomic events, and to put that in a way that is acceptable and understanding for consumers.
And when you say markets, I mean, we're talking about, when we say commodities, we're talking about such a broad spectrum of different things. And I mean, which are your favourites or your specialisms?
So, my background is actually the steel industry, which is a 1.6 billion tonne industry per annum. I mean, think 1.6 billion tonnes of steel. That's a lot of steel we consume in the world. Half of that consumed in China every year. But then you can look more recently, of course, electric vehicles have all been the rage. And you start to look at the cobalt market, which is only 100,000 tonnes. So you have a vast array of commodities, and there's always things to write about, and there's always things to talk about. There's always a lot going on.
Okay, look, we've got an idea of where you each come from. I have no idea, really, how this market works. Give me a typical transaction. Come on, Andrew, tell me a typical transaction, something that Trafigura would do, just so we get the sort of gist of how this works.
Well, a typical and topical transaction, shall we say, is the purchase of oil from the booming US shale fields of Texas. And there we have a significant gathering operation right out in the scrublands of the Permian Basin, buying sometimes from small mom-and-pop producers, aggregating the oil together, transporting it down through pipelines to a storage terminal in Corpus Christi, Texas, which was built by us, and then put onto very large crude carriers, supertankers, and taken to China. Typically, there's been a huge surge of U.S. crude exports since the ban on them was lifted by the U.S. Congress in December 2015, and increasingly a lot of that has been going to China.
Okay, so you've got a deal with the people who are digging the oil out of the ground, who own the rights to the oil. You buy their oil, you put it together, you put it on a tanker, and you take it to someone who's going to buy the oil.
And right, and all the logistical steps on the way, including a major storage terminal, because sometimes the oil will be produced and not needed at that point when prices are low in the present day. Then you'll want to store it rather than putting it on a tanker. So having storage capacity is really important. Right. Sometimes you need so much storage capacity that you have to put it in store on supertankers. It's floating out at sea. All of these, you have to have all these instruments to play with.
I mean, commodity house, trading house are doing something quite simple. They are sourcing the most strategic, materials we need in life and where it is produced, wherever it is produced, and making sure that as a consumer, we don't have any disruption. That's as simple as that. This is 25% of world trade. This is $4.5 billion worth of dollars.
Yeah, and it's amazing how little we talk about it. I suppose I'm interested in where the money goes. So what's often amazed me is how valuable companies like Trafigura and Glencore are for a sort of middlemen role. And I suppose what you've described is a very dull supply chain. You know, you buy it from the one end and sell it at another end. And yet the companies like yours seem to be the kind of so valuable in this market.
Well, it's hard to gauge the real value because most of the companies are private, and the one that's public is a mining company before it's a trading company.
Right, right.
That's Glencore. But in our case, in terms of where the value is created and how we add value, it's really in understanding the global market, the price differentials between a commodity in one place and a commodity in another place, or between a commodity now and a commodity a year in the future, or between a commodity of one blend and a differently blended commodity that's actually required in the market. Managing all those, what we call arbitrages, is where you get the money. And just to put it in a simple way, if the cost of moving a commodity from A to B is X, and the price differential between place A and place B is X plus, you've got a profit.
Yes.
It is a very thin profit. Actually, profit per ton, or the margin in the business, is a very small. It's typically about 1.5%.
Yeah, to expand on that for us, Colin, on what the kind of margins are and what that even means, because when you're moving such large amounts, you would expect the margin to be quite small.
Well, and it's interesting, of course, in any given value chain, there's a lot of individual subsets, all of which need to make money. Because that's the way economics works. I mean, if you're not making money doing a part of the chain, there's no point in doing it. So it's interesting. I would say, typically what we've seen over the past 20 years is a shift whereby the extractive industries have been gaining more share of revenue because we've been in a pretty good demand environment, actually.
You mean the people who do the mining?
People who are actually getting it out the ground. And that could be oil extraction, that could be mining extraction. I mean, that could be the farmer on the agricultural side.
That would be companies like Rio.
Rio Tinto, for example, the biggest supplier of iron ore into the global market.
But you see, I think we have to admit that although the business is a real physical business, Trafigura is actually taking oil, putting it on a tanker and moving it, it is also a financial business, isn't it? Because essentially you are a kind of hedge fund making bets on all sorts of transactions.
I would actually take issue with hedge fund because we do hedging to cover ourselves against the risk of price fluctuations, but we are buyers of the derivatives markets. We're not players of them.
You don't play?
It's not a speculative business. We do not take directional bets on commodities prices. We use the futures markets to lock in prices so that we don't have to manage the risk of oil going up 20 or down.
Is that really true, Andrew? You don't think of yourself as having a kind of financial arm whose business is to...
We do have
a proprietorial trading arm who speculates.
We do have a financial arm which is to do with raising finance and structuring finance and providing credit to our customers. That's a very important line of activity. And we do have risk that we have to manage between the differentials. So it's not, is Brent or WTI crude going to be $10 up next week? That would be a bet that would be not for us to take. But if we know that the differential is mismatched in a particular, or prices are mismatched in a particular differential from one's part of the globe to the other, then we will take a position there. But that's at the margin. It's not the centre of the business.
Right, so it's not the $10 rise. It's the difference between one market and another market.
And you know, I think that if traders were really doing that, buying, sitting on the cargo and waiting for better times, etc. I mean, we're talking massive quantities. We are talking massive amounts of money. It is just impossible for them to do that properly.
So what
they're doing, in other words, is optimizing. And optimizing, making sure that at the end of the day, we get what we need and they source it at the best possible price. And in order to do that, they have to use the financial markets. This business would not exist without the financial market. It doesn't mean they're speculating. It means that they had protecting themselves.
But there are people who are speculating. I mean, some of them are your customers, Colin. You're writing them in Market Intelligence so they can work out what bets to take. I mean, so that may not be Trafigura, but there are...
I mean, if we think of it, your average pension portfolio, there is probably a portion of that invested in commodities. Normally, that's just a differentiator, but... of course, that can be in a fund which is purely taking long positions in commodity futures, or it can be people taking directional bets, and that is the way markets are. Now, it's interesting. The commodities which have not had futures markets tend actually to be more volatile because they're set by a physical price. Actually, financial market activity is a volatility curber.
You say that activity... actually has a sort of stabilising effect.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
So essentially you're saying that the idea that created shortages are a kind of a typical feature of this market is for the birds.
And if we think of it, price allocates resource. That's what people always say. And price goes to a level which will get you either a supply reaction or will get you some demand substitution. Now, in many cases,
what you mean by that is if the price goes up, people will start producing more. The Texans will start digging more.
There's this. There's always a lag, and that's what gives rise to the fluctuation. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a market with relatively inelastic demand, like oil, and you've got a cartel of producers in OPEC who want to drive the market one direction or another, they've got considerable potential to do that by controlling supply.
We had a really good grounding in the sort of working of the industry, so thank you for that. Andrew, give us a history of how this used to work, because one of the weirdo things I find is companies like yours, you're all quite young. I mean, you're not stalwarts of the capitalist system. How on earth were we doing this before we had these giant commodity trading houses?
Well, if you take the oil market, only slightly oversimplifying, in the 60s, it was basically controlled by a relatively small number of large, globally integrated oil companies, the majors, the Seven Sisters.
The
BPs and the
Exxons, etc. And they basically controlled everything from producing it out of the ground, piping it through, getting it to consumers, refining it on the way and storing it. It was a vertically integrated market. That started to break down really in the 1970s when countries woke up to the value of the resources they were sitting on, started nationalising them, driving out the majors, the Seven Sisters, from some of their most lucrative provinces and doing it themselves. The majors then went more into trading and focused on finding new resources that were outside OPEC. And then you've got the breakdown of the vertical integration and you get a more complex supply chain where countries are specialising in producing it. Some of the oil companies are getting out of the downstream altogether, refining is also becoming a concentrated and very specialised business. And so it's much more fragmented. And you needed a breed of company to come up.
To join the bits together.
Exactly, to organise the supply chain. And that really started in the person of Mark Rich, in a way, the sort of godfather of the industry.
Yeah, but his name comes up. He was the one who saw that there was value to be created by linking up
one of the buying and selling.
Yes, yeah. One of the ones.
Yeah, his name comes up in your company, the origins of your company, doesn't
Correct.
It? Correct. And in Glencore.
So sort of Glencore was Mark Rich,
and it was renamed.
And Trafigura was founded by six former senior employees of Mark Rich who broke away to form Trafigura. It was an interesting moment.
We do have to talk about the kind of dodgy reputation that the industry has. Mm-hmm. So really interesting, Mark Rich, this character who we think of as the godfather of the modern commodities trading businesses. Well, he was indicted in the US on tax evasion and controversial oil deals. Trafigura, for many people, Andrew, is synonymous with only one transaction that they know of, which was the dumping of some toxic waste in Abidjan and Ivory Coast, paying huge compensation to the Ivory Coast government. I could go on. Glencore at the moment is currently being investigated for activities in the DRC. Are the public right to think there is something a bit different ethically to this industry to what mostly we would expect of big companies?
As I said, we need the commodities. You have to source the commodity in places where they are produced. Guess what? They're not always produced in the United States. They're not always produced in Canada. They can be produced in DRC.
The Congo.
And then DRC suddenly look at the economy of DRC. They rely 100% on the commodities exports. So what's at stake there is, of course, totally strategic for them. Then dealing with these people is not like going to the LME market and purchasing in a very transparent way the commodities. So I have some sympathy with the fact that traders, they have to deal with something that we, as consumers, we don't want to watch. The question, this doesn't make them dodgy. But because at the end of the day, we need the cobalt. The world needs the cobalt.
Yeah, so you're taking the example of cobalt, which is very much in Democratic Republic of Congo.
60% of cobalt is produced.
And if we need it for batteries, and if we're going to have batteries, someone's got to go in there and deal with
it. And it doesn't mean to do it at any price. And by the way, this is not what they're doing. And Andrew can give very good example about that. I mean, the traders, they want to have a proper deal. They hate this transaction where they could get in trouble, okay? And they don't want to have children working in the mines. That's a fact, right? Why would they? This is mad when you're communicating and when you're refinancing your books on the bond market. You don't do these things. But so what they do, they bring good governance in this country.
But this is all about risk management in very difficult parts of the world. I think it's fair to say that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when commodities trading in its modern form was starting up, it was a very different story. It was in the shadows, and people liked to stay that way at the time. And no doubt some things went on then that would not really bear very close scrutiny today. Nevertheless, the fact is that the world has changed, is changing. Markets have become more transparent. And I think recent events in all sorts of places, especially the United States, have demonstrated how damaging it can be for a company to get caught on the wrong side of those things. So people who want to stay in business in this game now know that they have to be absolutely rigorous about compliance. We deal in those difficult countries, and we have to take the right risks in the right way.
You've been quite quiet on this, Colin, because I'd be really interested in actually on your take.
In my view, I mean, if we look at where they come from, naturally, many commodities in emerging markets go hand in hand, both for supply and demand, the key drivers. To me, I think the industry itself does not explain itself very well in terms of how it can help drive economic development.
Well, clearly, for some of the countries with minerals, it's the best card they've got. I suppose what worries me sometimes is these countries will have fairly non-benevolent dictators running them, and it pays the dictator to come to a deal with the mining company or the commodities house rather than to think about that deal as being done with the people of that country. and it'll be cheaper for, I don't know, a big mining company to pay the dictator than to pay the people.
This is a very big issue. It comes up every time resources are under discussion or emerging market finance is under discussion and NGOs are present, and they're quite right. It's a big issue, corruption in resource-producing countries and the resources curse, which is why an organisation like the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which we're a part of and most of the world's oil and mining companies are as well, is so important. That's an organisation that's generating disclosure about payments to governments for resources in those countries.
And it's interesting, from the investment community standpoint, of course, there is now a natural overlay about your environmental and social governance. Pretty much every pension fund in developed markets now will have that overlay. And mining companies and trading houses are having to react to that and having to come up with statements. And they can now be judged on these statements. I don't think it's a big step to say, I said compensation will be linked to their environmental and social governance. So the industry is improving, but I think there's just a lot of education process to go through.
Okay, look, for the last section here, I'd like to talk about where commodities are going. We've talked about the structure of the industry and its behaviour, but where are commodities going? So this gets us to the knotty subject of peak oil, because the big thing is, we've hinted at already, the big thing is decarbonisation of the global economy. So we won't need as much oil. And what does that mean for your business model, Andrew, which is moving oil around? And where do the new pressures come? Is it cobalt? Is it the stuff that makes batteries? So talk me through the kind of the next 15 years of your business, because it is all quite exciting point we're at the moment.
What we've been through in the past 15 years is a really rapid growth rate. Many of these commodity markets are double the size they were back in 2000. And that's down to the fact that we're, number one, bigger population globally, but also we've had heavy, rapid industrialisation of China. Now, then China's kind of getting towards peak growth rate, shall we say. And we don't expect the same sort of growth rate over the coming years. But we're still looking at markets that are supporting a bigger base. So just to keep us going, if you want, we need more commodities than ever before. And therefore, we're having to look at increasingly difficult areas to go and look for them. Just as an example of copper here. We've known about every copper project in the world for at least 20 years now. And guess what? We mined the good ones back then because they made the best financial sense. Now we're moving to a situation where we're having every incremental project is probably lower grade, higher cost, higher in a frontier region, perhaps.
Needing more traders to blend it.
Needing more traders to blend it, of course, Andrew. we're still seeing pressure, if you want, on the supply side. It's interesting. Long-term trend for commodity pricing is actually flat in inflation-adjusted terms.
So the expectation is, despite all you're saying, if you look at what the future prices are meant to be, market prices or analysts' expectations, that they're flattish.
Generally flattish. I mean, we have had cobalt prices up fourfold from the lows because suddenly we're needing a lot more. It is interesting. The battery, both for electric vehicles and for storage, is going to be a big growth area over the coming years, but it's coming off a very low base. Coming back to things like, I mean, liquefied natural gas received a lot of investment, LNG, and now we're starting to see the fruits of that come through. We'll see a lot more LNG in the world as part of decarbonisation. That's going to have to start to price in against coal. In the UK, where we sit, I mean, 2 years ago, 30% of our electricity came from coal. That's now down to 6% and is probably going to zero.
I think that's a really interesting point because you mentioned peak oil. I mean, this is a very complex and long transition. People are right about the direction. They're very often wrong about timing. Guessing a date for peak oil is probably another mug's game. But the fact of the matter is it's driving changes in commodity patterns of consumption. Oil is continuing to grow. Look at the growth of the global vehicle fleet expected to take place over the next 15 years. It's still very, very large. Some of that will be electric vehicles. Some of that will be internal combustion engines. So it's very complex. It's a transition for all commodities, including the metals.
It's a transition, but when I look at the BP outlook for 2018, it's quite interesting.
This is the BP producer BP kind of statistical guide to what's going
statistical
on.
Guide. Guess what? They're saying that, you know, China is the largest consumer of energy in the world, okay, and will remain so, okay? And guess what? In 2040, according to BP, guess what would be the first energy that China requires?
Oil.
Coal.
Coal?
Coal. The second one would be...
Oil.
No, would be renewables.
Okay.
And the third one will be oil. That's the transition. But we're talking 2040.
It is fascinating.
It's fascinating, right?
One much more immediate problem for your sector, and I wonder how much influence it has on the commodity side as opposed to produced manufactured goods, is trade wars. We're in the middle of something quite astonishing here. The global rules-based system seems to be being largely dismantled by the United States. Obviously, big implications for China, big implications for whether global blocs are trading as much with each other, and certainly big implications for the steel market, because steel has been on the front line of the trade war. Colin, how important is this trade war?
Trade wars, historically, we haven't had one of this scale for a long, long time. And we go back and we look at the precedents, and they're not good. I mean, they do tend to impact demand, because what's happening? The price of steel in the US has had to go up, because the US is going to be an importer. It doesn't, quite frankly, have enough productive capacity. And therefore, that's getting passed straight down through the chain. It's getting passed on to the machinery firms who are passing it on to the end consumer. And the average man in the street is paying more for his automobile than he would have done otherwise. Any US infrastructure spending is now probably 25% more expensive than it was before, just on the cost of raw materials. It's certainly having an impact. It will redirect trade globally. And, commodities are at the forefront of trade friction, and say they're very emotive businesses in that regard.
I mean, for the markets, trade wars and tariffs and so forth are things we watch very closely, but they're also trading opportunities, one has to say. For a trader, understanding these things means moving commodities in different ways. And I think the important thing is that commodities are very fungible. You know, they're
by
going
which
to,
you mean you can swap one for another.
Exactly. So if China puts tariffs on US oil, which they've talked about, that oil's going to go somewhere else, and they'll buy oil from somewhere else.
True. But think about soybean. Soybean is 390 million tons a year of soybean. 100 million tons are consumed by China. Three producers in the world, main producers, US, Brazil, and Argentina. Okay? Now, the Chinese are going to put tariffs on the imports of soybean from the US. Do you know how much they're importing from the US every year of soybean? 36 million tons. 36 million tons. Where are they going to find this soybean? I mean, which is now too expensive. So the price of soybean is sinking, just to make up for this. And do you think that Brazil, we think of Argentina, can provide an additional 36 million tons?
Yeah, so they'll import soybeans from the US and then they'll sell theirs to the Chinese, so that the net effect
Is that the Chinese need these 36 million tons, which is one third of their consumption. And this is coming from North Hemisphere. Normally, I mean, don't forget, Brazil and Argentina are in the South Hemisphere. So the crops are inverted. So in the beginning of the year, you're importing the soybean from Latin America. At the end of the year, you're importing from the Northern Hemisphere. And that was the United States. So watch this space. This is going to be very interesting. And the Chinese are implementing taxes on the US oil as well.
I think we should leave it there. What a fascinating discussion, sort of a whole lot of different areas. Look, let me thank you all. Andrew Gowers, Head of Corporate Affairs at Trafigura. Jean-François Lambert, founder of Lambert Commodities Limited, Lambert Commodities Limited, and Colin Hamilton, Managing Director for Commodities Research at BMO Capital Markets. Thank you all. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back with more guests next week.